Good morning. This is the San Francisco Newsroom. In just a moment, we'll bring you the news of this warring world as we prepare to take you overseas to hear from our correspondents directly on the scene and to the nation's capital for a report of this country's activities. First, we take you across the Pacific to hear from Harrison Foreman in Chungking, China. Go ahead, Chungking.
Foreman in Chungking. It's exactly 7 o'clock in the evening here, Tuesday evening. The spotlight of world attention is tonight focused sharply on the bitter battle for Singapore. The stakes are high, and the Japs know it. For which reason, they've thrown everything they had into the battle. But even should Singapore eventually succumb to this overwhelming three-dimensional assault, the feeling here in China is that this will by no means represent anything decisive with respect to the ultimate conclusion of the war. It will merely delay somewhat the inevitable Allied victory. Expressing this general belief at the regular weekly press conference a few hours ago, the government spokesman said, in her 4 years of fighting alone against Japan, China has had too many trying experiences to lose confidence or courage. Each reverse served only to add a new armor of iron and blood to her determination to fight on to the finish. The present critical situation in Singapore and Burma is only a spur to even more resolute action, which will ensure the combined triumph of the Allies over Japan. Nevertheless, he continued, we are standing at the portals of one of the greatest ordeals on our way to victory. And then, reflecting the feeling here that the Battle of Burma, which to Chinese means the Battle of the Burma Road, is of even greater importance than the Battle of Singapore, the spokesman went on. We may particularly underscore the fact that if the defense of Burma is successfully carried out, the Allies had every reason to count upon the steady growth of Chinese force, an effective use of China as a potent base for an early counteroffensive against Japan. If, on the contrary, the Burma Road should be disrupted by the enemy, China's difficulties will increase, and so too will the difficulties of the Allies in a corresponding measure. Concluding, the spokesman warned, in the defense of Burma, therefore, we must neither lose time nor shrink from cost. It would not be too much to urge that the Battle of Burma must be fought out as a Battle of Moscow in the Far East if the Allies are going to force an early collapse of the Japanese army. There is, however, some puzzlement here as to why Chinese troops in Burma have as yet not contacted the enemy. The Chungking press discusses this question freely. The Catholic Yishabok, for example, says, for the sake of executing the pledge of placing her manpower and resources at the disposal of the Allies, China cannot grudge any sacrifice in keeping Burma from falling into enemy hands. If British and Indian forces suffice for Burma's defense, China would be only too glad to be spared sacrifices outside her own territory. Just what the real situation is, China, out of all sincerity and frankness, wishes to know. Our true friends never stand on ceremony, so the Allies should be frank. If assistance is needed, there should be no beating around the bush about such need. In the common military cause, there should be no racial prejudice. Otherwise, the enemy may take advantage of the situation. The influential Central Daily News assures, furthermore, that China has no ulterior designs or ambitions, aside from the common cause against aggression. Wherever and howsoever she can best serve that cause with her manpower and material resources, she will act without hesitation. In the Battle of Burma, Chinese troops will fight hard side by side with British forces there. And in the event of a general Allied offensive in the entire Southwest Pacific, they will be willing to continue the fight on any front that the Allies may designate. I return you now to San Francisco.
Now we take you to the newsroom in New York.
Here in New York, we have news from Moscow. Further Red Army gains were reported by the Soviet Information Bureau today. The report said 7 towns were recaptured, but did not give their names or locations. On the Kalinin Front, 95 miles northwest of Moscow, was the only front named in the midday communique. This communique said a Russian column killed 400 German officers and men in 2 assaults and then repulsed a Nazi counterattack. These gains came on top of a night communique which pictured the Germans floundering westward in disordered retreat from one village to another. Once again, we go overseas and hear from our reporter in the capital of Great Britain.
This is London. John McVane speaking. The British defenders of Singapore Island have failed to stop the drive of the invading Japanese. Yesterday, the hope was expressed that the British could clean up the Japanese landing parties before nightfall. But London heard from Singapore today that the enemy pressure became so strong that the British had to fall back again. The Japanese blasted the British troops all yesterday with dive bombing and machine gunning attacks from the air and a heavy artillery bombardment. The British are stated to have fought stubbornly, but the Japanese succeeded in infiltrating through and pressed back the British defenses. The latest official word reaching London from Singapore tells of new enemy landings in the area between Sungai Mundi and Sungai Kranji. Dive bombing and high-level bombing of the British troops has continued, and so has Japanese infiltration. Authoritative quarters in London see very little comfort in the Singapore situation. The Japanese claim to have repaired the causeway connecting the island with the mainland isn't confirmed here, but it is admitted as a possibility. London believes the Japanese may be as near as 10 miles from the city itself, but it's thought the Japanese claim to have penetrated within 5 miles is exaggerated. It's stated here that the British troops have been withdrawn from the first defense lines and are now consolidating their second line of defense. Mr. Churchill, representing Britain, is presiding over a Pacific Council meeting in London today to plan a common war policy in the Far East and cooperate with the Washington Pacific Council. Other representatives at the meeting are Cyril Page of Australia, Mr. Jordan of New Zealand, and Mr. Gerbrandy of Holland. The absence of the United States is explained by the fact that Britain and America have already reached complete unanimity. I think that most people in Britain realize that what is happening in Singapore would happen. The information that the British couldn't put up a real fighter protection over the island prepared public opinion here for the bad news from the naval base when the Japanese invasion should begin. The reports that some hurricanes have been in action over the island and have shot down a few Japanese raiders hasn't done anything to shake the average man's belief that the enemy have overwhelming air superiority. And the British know what that means. But in spite of being prepared for it, news of the early Japanese successes still comes as a shock to the British. One woman said today, "I knew they could probably make a landing, but I never thought they'd push our boys back so soon." Many people here have more than a strategic interest in the fighting in Singapore. Personal cables take weeks to arrive here from the island, and there are many families who haven't heard from their menfolk in Malaya for months. One British officer I know wrote his family 5 or 6 months ago that he was stationed far out in the jungle. He said, "The worst thing at the moment is the snakes, but the Japanese may come along any day now." His family haven't heard from him since the Japanese did come. Another Londoner I know wired a brother in Malaya 6 weeks ago. He hasn't had any answer. People like these don't see much comfort in the reports that are reaching London now. They're likely to take to heart the words of one British commentator who says, "No one can look at the map of the island without feeling the bitter irony of defense plans which placed the great naval base on the northern shore, now the most vulnerable part, and girdled the southern coastline with massive fortifications and heavy guns. Sufficient, it was reasonably thought, to keep any onslaught from the sea at bay." Most comment takes the line that the Allies must speed up their production, for on production hangs all the Allied strategy and tactics. The Daily Herald says, "Our forward troops, dive-bombed and shelled, were being pushed back. Superior mechanical power was asserting its inevitable superiority. We do not know the strength of the defending forces or the reinforcements they may receive, but this we know, that every step of the Japanese advance so far has been owed above all to the superiority of equipment, and the Japanese advances have already been fast enough and dangerous enough to cure us of any remaining complacency about our rate of production." This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
And next, Earl Godwin, speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. While John McVane was talking there, I got A queer memory. I remember sitting in the football stands at Urbana, Illinois, to watch Red Grange run down the field against the Michigan team. Nothing seemed to stop him. I wonder if that's an unworthy thought, but it seems to me the way those Japs are going down that stretch of land puts a 77 on their back, and that was Grange's number. Tremendous moves in Washington. Still excited about such trifles as Donald Duck and pint-sized retirement pay for congressmen. Possibly most important individual move is an unspectacular move, but it's the creation of a single pool into which all United Nations cargo ships are to be floated, to be administered by the outstanding genius of the war in his line, I mean Admiral Emery S. Land, Jr., chairman of the Maritime Commission. This move, announced by the president or from the White House yesterday, is the shipping czar that I predicted to you one day last week. It's a natural move, paralleling the United Command move, and is calculated to get the most use out of the ships in their loading and in their routing. The House of Representatives, which has been raring to go and boiling over, administered that verbal spanking to the Office of Civilian Defense and its fan-dance fandangos, but the only thing that went out of that ragtag and bobtail bill as it moved uproariously through the House was Donald Duck. The rest of the disputed items stay right where they are because, despite all of that criticism, the pay for the 37 criticized friends of Mrs. Roosevelt's comes from another bill entirely. And so these folks will be on the payroll until July 1, at least. The criticism which stopped the show was criticism against a show that really hasn't reached town. But the $80,000 to pay Walt Disney for that entertaining Donald Duck film, which makes tax-paying or income tax-making so easy, was dropped from the bill, despite the fact that the movie has been made, contracted for, and is being displayed, at least here in Washington. But congressional attitude is against the whole matter. That is, a majority of Congress is. The Senate takes this all up in a few days. Meantime, Mrs. Roosevelt will be invited to explain the civil morale program, and she has said, of course, that she'd like to meet some of these congressmen and tell them what it's all about. Washington is again excited, too, over the protests of the folks back home against the so-called pensions for congressmen. Actually, they're not pensions. They are a part of a retirement fund into which the congressmen can, if they want, put 5% of their pay every month. Well, anyhow, there's a terrific uproar throughout the country. And as a consequence, there is this growing movement for repeal of this section of the civil service retirement law here in Washington. Incidentally, some congressmen say they don't exactly know what's in that pension bill. They have been criticized, however, by Representative Vincent of Georgia, who says, "What's a congressman here for except to find out what's going on?" Well, and now if Congress doesn't understand what is being done by Congress, can anybody blame the general public? But can anyone admire the situation wherein we face a week of somber and dangerous defeats and retreats by the United Nations before this flood of Japs? And the biggest feature of the American scene, or the loudest feature of the American scene here, is the excitement over a comic film, two or three dancers and actors, and this pint-sized annuity which not one man in 10,000 really understands. Roosevelt is a Navy man himself. He picks naval men every now and then to do big jobs. He picked an Admiral Stanley, his first chief of operations, now retired, to be ambassador to Russia. He already picked Bill Leahy, another top-flight admiral, retired, to be ambassador at Vichy, and what a good job he's done despite it all. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And that's this morning's news at home and abroad. Your reporters were Harrison Foreman from Chungking, John McVane from London, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.